Good morning, and it's time for conversation here on this wet WIP day. My name's Peter Solomon. While the conversation may be wet, the conversation is also going to be high and intriguing. When we come back in just a bit, we're going to be talking, so chase the kids. We're going to be talking women's orgasms and a whole lot more. Yes, orgasms. What does a man know about orgasms? Well, we'll find out when we come back in just a bit. I know very little. Her name, Zanet Pallett. She's going to tell us what we need to know. All this and more coming up here on 94 WIP. My name's Peter Solomon. More in just a bit. And we're back, and hopefully you've chased the kids because you're here on 94 WIP All Sports Radio. My name's Peter Solomon. We're going to be talking a very adult subject. We're going to be talking women, pleasure, orgasms, and a whole lot more. So get ready, and let me say good morning to Zanet Pallett. Good morning, Zanet.
Good morning, Peter. It's Janae. I know everybody thinks it's like Xanax, but it's Janae.
Good morning, Janae. All right.
Good morning.
Are we obsessed with orgasms on some level?
As a society, absolutely we're obsessed with orgasms. You know, we see it everywhere, right? Especially in all of the media. You know, we're always seeing women having these explosive, or women and men when they're having sex, having these explosive orgasms, always simultaneously. So, yes, I think there's a little bit of an obsession with them.
I was watching one of my favorite sitcoms, Mom, and they were discussing Mom's orgasms, and he said, "She levitated." And I went, "Whoa, TV's come a long way since I was a kid."
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, that's interesting. She levitated. I like that. I guess in some ways people do levitate if they really, when you really have a very intense sort of out-of-body experience, it kind of feels like you're levitating at some level. So that was a pretty good line.
But is it a good thing for our society to talk about it?
Is it a good thing to be talking about orgasm?
Yes.
I think it is a good thing to be talking about. I mean, you know, I think there's two aspects of this. There's the fact that there's a lot of performance pressure that's put on both women and men around orgasms. And I think that's a negative because that's what causes a lot of women to fake orgasms. And it's what, you know, causes a lot of couples to have challenges around their sexual relationship because of all of that, all of those expectations and performance pressures, right? So in one way, you know, over-talking about it or putting so much pressure on it is a negative. On the other hand, you know, orgasmic energy is very powerful. You know, orgasms have a lot of different health benefits. They release a lot of different really positive hormones. I just heard all of these like health and wellness, you know, ads on this program, and having regular orgasms, whether it's with a partner or by yourself, really can be, it can be really improve your health, provides a lot of immunity, and is relaxing, reduces stress and anxiety and, you know, some of the things that cause chronic disease.
Is it different for men than it is for women? I mean, the biology is different, but is the process different?
Well, let me think about that. I mean, biologically, orgasms are the same thing, right? Biologically, orgasms are a release of sexual energy that may end up feeling like a contraction, even though it's actually about relaxation. I think the process is different in terms of how to get to orgasms. Just given the way men are anatomically built, I like to say that men's, you know, sexual equipment is on the outside of the body. And so most men get aroused a lot easier and then can therefore come to an orgasm a lot faster than women can. Women, our arousal equipment is more internal inside of our body, and women need a lot more, most women, generalization here, but but most women need a lot more time to actually get aroused, right? So foreplay is actually very important for women. But the actual, like, process, physiological process of orgasm is identical. Getting there is different.
Sure is. Men get, if they're lucky, get one. Women can get multiples, can't they?
Yes, definitely. Men, men typically have a longer period of time between when they can get another orgasm, another erection. Women do not have that. It's called a refractory period. Women do not have that refractory period, and are multi-orgasmic is what we say. So women can have one orgasm after another after another. It doesn't always happen, but it's definitely possible.
How'd they get so lucky?
They are lucky. We are very lucky. But, you know, men can become multi-orgasmic as well through a practice of learning how not to actually ejaculate. You can have what's called non-ejaculatory orgasms, which is basically moving the energy through the body because orgasms and ejaculation for both women and men are actually two different physiological functions. While they usually happen together, they do not have to happen together.
Now, that's interesting because I think most people think they go together like love and marriage.
Exactly. And like I said, most of the time they do, but they are separate functions. You can have one without the other, and you can have many without the other, too. But it's a process of learning some very specific breathing techniques, learning how to manage your sexual energy. So it's not like something that happens, you know, overnight. You have to work at it a little bit as a man, a little bit different for women who it just the physiological function, because ejaculation doesn't affect our refractory period. We just don't have that process. We don't have that problem, which is good for us and good for men too.
Oh, absolutely. But at the same time, it makes people uncomfortable to talk about it. I go back to that. I mean, I'm thinking about this interview, and I have a certain level of discomfort just even doing the interview. I confess. But it's important.
Yeah. Thanks for naming that. Yes. And thanks for, you know, doing the interview despite it, despite your discomfort. Yeah, we have a lot of shame around our sexuality and being able to talk about it just out in general. And even, you know, with our partners, you know, there's just it's kind of we're socialized, we're conditioned as children to not be comfortable talking about our bodily functions, to not be comfortable touching ourselves for many of us. And, you know, we bring that into adulthood, unfortunately, and that does have an impact on our sex life, because when we have a lot of shame and discomfort around our body and our sexuality, it makes it a lot harder to really, like, open up sexually to the extent in which you can have multiple orgasms, right? There's a level of being really connected with your own body and your sexuality and your pleasure, which is part of being able to be that, if you will, orgasmic.
You think it's different when it's sex with love as opposed to what some people might term recreational sex?
I don't think there is any generalization around that. I think different people are different. You know, I certainly have clients in my sex and intimacy coaching practice who will tell me that the best sex that they've ever had was anonymous, like with a stranger one night. And typically these are women. Typically those are women who have maybe had a lot of shame around sex. And so having anonymous sex, if you will, or recreational sex, really there's no stigma associated with it because they know they're never going to see this person again and they're not going to be in a relationship with them. So there's no generalization. Having said that, I think that for a lot of people, But and again, I think this is more so women, because for a lot of women, we actually need to feel very emotionally connected with a partner in order to open ourselves up sexually. So a lot of women feel like they can really let their guard down. They can be more vulnerable. They can, you know, really express themselves when they're not having recreational sex, when they're having sex with a partner. I know that there's quite a bit of data that shows, especially in the younger generation, in the millennials, that, you know, college students are doing a lot of faking of orgasms, that recreational sex doesn't really necessarily allow a woman to open herself up to be able to relax and have an orgasm, because you kind of need to have some level of relaxation in addition to arousal in order to let go.
All right. Faking it. I know women do it. I've probably been with some women who've done it. But at the same time, is there a way to tell?
It's a little hard to tell if a woman's faking it, because every woman's orgasm is going to be different. Sometimes, you know, some women have a very strong they'll have a very strong release in the body. And so, you know, you might feel like her body quivering or a little bit of shaking, but, you know, that doesn't always happen. So, I mean, there are physiological things when you actually happen that when you actually have an orgasm, often you get flushed, right? There'll be heat that you might feel in the body, on the face. But, you know, it's not that easy to tell. Especially if it's somebody who's not your partner and you've not been with before. So, you know, I don't know. I've never seen the, like, faking orgasm test. But, you know, I don't know. I think some women are really good at faking it, and their partners never know that they've actually faked an orgasm. It's hard.
Does it make any difference how you get there?
In terms of faking it?
No, not in terms of faking it, just in general. I mean, there's several different ways a woman can have an orgasm. Several different activities, if you will.
Right. I mean, there's a lot of different, you know, you can have an orgasm. I don't know what I can say and not say on the show, Peter, so I'm trying to be very PG-13 here. But, you know, there's a lot of different types of orgasms that women can have, and there's a lot of different ways in which they can have an orgasm, right? There's, you know, for a lot of women, kind of the trifecta, if you will, of orgasm is, it's interesting, it's deep passionate kissing is something that is helps a woman have an orgasm, combined with oral sex, combined with some sort of, like, clitoral stimulation, like that's kind of, or G-spot stimulation, that's kind of the trifecta of orgasm. But deep passionate kissing is an important part of female orgasm, which is sometimes not part of the equation in, you know, in a sexual encounter. Obviously, you can't always do all three at the same time, but there's a buildup that's, you know, kind of part of it. So different women get turned on from different things. You need to kind of explore with your partner and see what they like and what they don't like. For a lot of women, oral sex is one of the best ways for a woman to have a clitoral orgasm. There's just a lot of stimulation from that you can't have from other types of clitoral stimulation. And, you know, it's a very, very sensual experience both for the women and the man, typically. And so it is a little bit dependent upon what your partner likes. But there are, you know, a lot of different ways in which a woman can have an orgasm that many people aren't even aware of, like, a G-spot orgasm is something that can be very intense and powerful for women. So these are more like internal orgasms inside of the vagina as opposed to external, which is a clitoral orgasm. And, you know, you can have a breast orgasm. You can have an ear orgasm, right? There's an orgasm just basically means that there's a big buildup of sexual energy and then a release of that sexual energy. And so there's many different ways. An anal orgasm, for example, is from anal sex as well. So women's, I like to say a woman's whole body can be orgasmic, which is really a beautiful thing when you think about it. So the way you get there will vary from person to person, but the key thing is to explore and see, like, what feels really good for me and, you know, what's something that we've never tried before.
You talked about an internal orgasm. Is that the mythical vaginal orgasm?
The mythical vaginal orgasm, yeah. That's the mythical vaginal orgasm, which is really not that mythical. Most women may be even having them and not realizing it because the vaginal orgasm feels a lot different than a clitoral orgasm. So like a clitoral orgasm, you feel a big release of energy going out. It's a big spurt, right? Like you're very aware that you've had an orgasm. But internal vaginal orgasms, which can be, you know, probably the easiest one to be able to access, is a G-spot orgasm. But women can also have orgasms from very deep penetration, from cervical orgasms, so from stimulation of the cervix, which some women love, and some women it's too sensitive and it doesn't feel good for them. It just really depends on their anatomy. But the type of internal orgasm, rather than it feeling necessarily like a burst of energy out, it's more like a very, very intense, kind of like you're surfing a wave. So there's not always this huge release of energy, but it's a lot of intense sensation. It just has a very different feel to it. And when I work with women and we talk about that and they're like, oh, I've never had a vaginal orgasm, and I'm like, well, have you ever had the, and this usually happens during, you know, either finger penetration or intercourse or using, like, you know, a dildo or something else. Like, have you ever had that, like, oh my God, what the F was that type of feeling in your body? And they're like, oh yeah, I've had that. Like, well, that is what a vaginal orgasm is. It's like a very, very, very intense release. But it's very different than a clitoral orgasm. It just feels different. I'd say more like surfing a wave.
And you're listening to Conversation here on 94 WIP All Sports Radio. My name's Peter Solomon. My guest this morning, Janae Pallett. She's an expert on sex and women's orgasms. Her new book, Built for Your Sex Life, The Top 12 Things for You This Year. Top 12 tips for you this year. We'll be right back after this. And we're back. Keep the kids out of the room because the hot conversation continues here on 94 WIP as we're talking with Janae Pallett, her new book. What is the title of the book, Janae?
Yeah, so the name of the book is Living an Orgasmic Life.
Okay.
Heal yourself and awaken your pleasure. Living an Orgasmic Life,
Living an Orgasmic Life. All right, Janae, how do you become an intimacy sex coach? I mean, that's something you heard about in high school career day.
Yeah, right. Yeah, not something I thought I was going to do when I graduated from law school. So I was a lawyer, or I am a lawyer by training, and I practiced law. I was in healthcare for, you know, 25 years or so. But during that period of time, I also lived in a sexless marriage, which is very, unfortunately, very common because, you know, we basically define a sexless marriage as a couple that has sex less than 10 times a year, which probably is a lot more common than we would want to think, especially in long-term relationships. But I was really in a sexless marriage because we didn't even have sex for like 15 years. It was a very, very long period of time. And when we finally left each other, I realized that there was an issue that I always had around sex, which was that sex actually was very uncomfortable and painful for me, which is another not that uncommon experience that women have. And it never actually got better. I mean, it was just always very uncomfortable for me. I never had pleasure. I didn't have orgasms. And so I did like a deep dive into my own, like, what is going on with me here, sexuality, which led me eventually to becoming a sex and intimacy coach, because as I did my own healing, like as I went through my own sexual healing journey and really began to understand where some of my issues were coming from, it also just got me very invested and interested in working with other women and other couples who were in sexless marriages to help them heal their relationship and help their heal their sexuality. So that's how I became a sex and intimacy coach. Other people enter that from a different place. A lot of people come in it from their social workers, and they're really interested in sexuality. But I came in it from, like, the wounded healer part.
Where do you go for training, though? I mean, stuff just doesn't come from the sky.
Yeah, no. I lived on the East Coast. And having just lived through like 20 degree weather, because I'm in New York City right now. I'm like, oh, this is why I moved to California. So now I'm living in California. There are a number of really excellent training programs, most of which are on the West Coast. Almost all of them are on the West Coast that I participated in. So I took a program, and my expertise and interest has always been in women's sexual health, so primarily. So I took a program with an amazing woman in Oregon called Tammy Lynn Kent, and I'm a holistic pelvic care practitioner, which means that I really help women connect with and clean out, if you will, blocked energy and issues that are in their pelvic bowl. And then I'm also a sexological body worker, and that is a training program only offered in California and in Europe, Canada, because it's a program where you really learn and you're certified to do very intimate touch with people, both women and men, so that you can help them heal issues. So we basically get through healing the body through the channel of pleasure, right? So a woman who has a hard time having an orgasm, if she came to see me in California and she was open to it, we would actually do like a sensual massage, which may lead to some more genital massage, or I call it a yoni massage, to help her really feel like, what does arousal feel like in her body? Because sometimes that's actually very, very helpful. And then I also did a program also in California with my teachers who are amazing, Celeste Hirschman and Danielle Harrell, called Somatica. So that's a somatic meaning a body-based approach to sex and intimacy. So I'm a somatic-based sex and intimacy coach. Which basically is a little bit more experiential. So we look at sexuality through the lens of touch. We look through at sexuality through the lens of not just talking to our clients about sex, which is what sex therapists do, but actually having them, you know, doing touching exercises. If I'm working with a couple or a woman, having them doing touching exercises with each other, teaching, you know, what does it really look like to have passionate sex with your clothes on? But, you know, literally, like, how do you touch somebody so that it feels good? How do you touch somebody so that you start building up arousal? Because there's different ways of touching. How do you move from very, like, for example, a very light, sensual, arousing touch to a more, like, passionate, I kind of want to take you touch, you know, teaching clients, like, how do you, if you're a male and with a female, or a female with a female, but you want to be a little bit more assertive, like, how do you do a hair pull, right? All of these different things that nobody ever teaches you, but you maybe learn it in quotes, you know, from watching the movies, but it's not real, right? So so it's a much more experiential-based approach to helping clients to be able to really learn more about their sexual needs and desires. We spend a lot of time helping people understand their fantasies and how important it is to, often fantasies really dictate, like, what is it that you really get turned on by sex, not just an act, but a feeling, an emotion that you want to have. So that's one of the greatest training programs I have. And then I'm also, because I see so much trauma, sexual abuse, physical abuse, emotional abuse, in all of my clients, men and women, I'm also trained in somatic experiencing, which is a trauma resolution program, also a body-based approach as well. So a lot of different, you know, training programs. I like to say I'm also a tantra educator and teacher as well. So I have a lot of different tools in my tool belt to be able to help clients really unblock their issues that are keeping them from really connecting with their sexuality, with their partner, with themselves.
Does health insurance pay for this?
Unfortunately, it does not. Some health insurance will pay for sex therapy, like if you work with a PhD or an MSW, you know, who's a sex therapist, but I'm not a licensed counselor. I'm not, I'm not an MSW, and I'm not a therapist. I'm a coach, and that's a different ball game altogether.
Okay, I don't know your marital status, but you must be very intimidating to date.
Yeah, I'm not married anymore. I'm single. Dating. Yeah, some people feel that way. Yes. And, you know, there are certain people that are like, oh, that's kind of cool. And they're not intimidated by it. So people who are intimidated, you know, I'm a pretty like chill person, and I enjoy, you know, connecting, with women and men, but, yeah, it's sometimes people are freaked out by it, and then they're just not the right dating partner for me. That's the way I roll.
How do you explain, though, I don't know if she's still alive, but how do you explain to your mother, or would you explain to your mother what you do?
No, my mother is not alive. I actually didn't start any of this until after she passed away, but I do have two adult children, and they're very well aware of the work that I do. So, you know, I think my mother was completely asexual. She, I think this was part of my issue. My dad died when I was 3, and she never remarried, never dated, ever. And she lived till 94. She was 40 when my father passed away. So that's another 54 years. I think my mother would have thought I was absolutely out of my mind crazy and wouldn't have been able to talk about it, because she was never able to talk about sex. But my kids are pretty cool about it. They're, you know, they know what I do. They know I wrote a book. They, you know, we have conversations. And I think growing up, even though my husband and I were not sexual with each other, you know, we were pretty cool parents with our kids. And, you know, for whatever reason, we were pretty open with them in talking about relationships and talking about sex, you know, when that came up. So, yeah, they're okay with it. Some of my friends in New York, because I did all this when I moved to California, thought I was nuts. You're doing what? But it's becoming a lot more common, you know, like especially on the West Coast. Well, because there's more training programs, you know, there's a lot more people, women and men, who are being trained as sex and intimacy coaches. It's actually becoming a little bit more common.
Probably some of those friends went from what to got any tips for me?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. I've had some sessions with them pro bono over wine.
Interesting. do you approach when you're working with a man? Because you don't work with a man by yourself, do you?
I do.
Okay.
I have worked with a lot of men. Currently, I'm focused my practice on working with primarily women and couples. So within the context of couples, I work with both women and men individually and together as a couple. But I also do have some male clients as well that I work with, and I've worked with a lot of men in the past. Men need a lot of help. They need a lot of support around this. I feel like a lot of men are really, they feel like they're clueless. They don't really understand women. They're really confused about women. Some men are confused about themselves and their own sexuality. And men are delightful. Most men are really delightful to work with. They're very, very respectful. I do a lot of screening before I accept somebody as a client in my practice, especially if it's in person. Most of my work now is virtual. A lot of it is. I really enjoy helping men, you know, feel better about themselves, have more confidence so that they can go out in the world and be like great partners and great lovers to women. Because, you know, women need that. We need men who know what they're doing. We need men who really want to understand us. We need men who can really communicate. Like, that's important.
Who's likely, though, to be more embarrassed, a man or a woman?
Say that one more time.
Who's likely to be more embarrassed, if you will, man or woman?
About what? About
the whole thing. You name it.
Oh, it depends. I think both people can be as embarrassed. In general, I would say, men have an easier time initially opening up to me. There's something about talking to a woman about sex that for most men just makes them more comfortable. I think in general, men are more connected to their sexuality than women are, for a variety of different reasons. And so talking about sex doesn't seem as challenging for a lot of men, even though we all have the shame message. Women have a much deeper and more profound and ingrained, I think, shame message around sexuality than most men do. So I guess I would say that it's probably harder for a woman to open up than it is for a man.
The reason I ask is I think men think they're supposed to know. That they're supposed to be born knowing.
Yeah. They're supposed to be born knowing how to give a woman an orgasm. I totally get that. But I feel like, you know, men in heterosexual normative relationships, right? Like, they just want to, most men are givers or pleasers. They want to make their partner feel good. And, you know, a lot of women don't know what they want, which makes men super, super frustrated. So they're often so happy to have some guidance. You know, my book is written from a woman's point of view, right? But, I mean, a lot of people who buy my book are men because men want to understand women's sexuality. They want to understand women's arousal. They want to understand how to help her get to, you know, a place of deep pleasure. And I think that's a beautiful thing. Yeah, I really appreciate that in men.
And you're listening to Conversation here on 94 WIP All Sports Radio. My name's Peter Solomon. More sex, orgasms, and a whole lot more coming up here on 94 WIP. We'll be back in just a bit. We're back. We're talking orgasms, women, sex, and a whole lot more with Jeanne Paulette, her new book, Living in an Orgasmic Life, Heal Yourself and Awaken Your Pleasure. My name's Peter Solomon. What's your position on external aids to get it going? Let's talk about pornography.
Oh, pornography. Like, what are you talking about? I think pornography can be great, right? For a lot of couples, they need some visual stimulation. I think, you know, using pornography, if that is something that you both like and enjoy and works for you, is perfectly fine and perfectly acceptable. The issue that I have with pornography is when there's so much reliance on pornography, particularly for men in, you know, masturbation, right? And I think particularly for the younger generation who's basically grown up, their sex education is pornography. And as we know, pornography is not really how people have sex. It's not the way it actually works. So, you know, learning about sex through pornography, I think, is problematic. Being addicted to pornography to the extent in which it actually starts interfering with your life, which, you know, I've certainly seen that with my clients, male clients. I've never seen it with female clients. It doesn't mean that it doesn't happen, is also problematic. But, you know, I'm pro-sex, which basically means anything that helps a couple have a great sexual relationship, whether it's watching a porn video or, you know, using toys or role-playing or having fantasy, whatever really turns them on and works for them, you know, I am definitely in support of. As long as the couple still feels connected with each other, right? Like, you know, if what it takes is a guy to watch a porn video to be able to have sex with a partner, then I would say, huh, there's something going on there, right? Unless she's part of the experience and they're doing it together, then it seems to me like there's something that's not clicking, that they're not able to figure out a way for him to get aroused without actually watching porn, then I think that maybe there's something I would want to look at in terms of what's actually going on sexually, what's actually going on in the context of their intimacy and their relationship. But, you know, if it's something that you do with your partner and it's part of your foreplay, then, you know, I'm not anti-porn, if you will. I'm anti doing things that keeps you disconnected.
They can sometimes, though, be how-to manuals, can't they?
Well, that's what I said, like, yeah. You know, but it's not a how-to manual. You know, most pornography is not accurate. You know, people do not have sex the way they have it in porn. Men don't get as, you know, men are not that size. You know, most porn stars are in the 95 percentile. Their penis size is in, like, the 90 to 95th percentile. Plus, they're plumped up with, you know, a variety of different things that are actually injected into their penis, and they're usually on some sort of Viagra. And people don't just walk in and start, like, having sex like the way they do in porn. So it's very, very poor sex education. It's often very misogynistic, right? It's really more for the man's pleasure than it is for the woman's pleasure. So it's not an accurate portrayal of the way in which most women really want to have sex. It's not what people see on porn. That's the problem. We don't really have, you know, we really don't have good sex education in most parts of the country. Maybe it's a little better in the Northeast than in the West Coast, but, you know, in most places we're not having really good sex education anymore. You know, people really are not learning about sex education from the perspective of pleasure, and from the perspective of communication, because good sex is about being able to communicate. There is no communication going on in pornography.
Amen to that. All right. You implied something earlier I want to make sure we touch on before we go, because we're starting to run out of time.
Sure.
If there's a problem, does it always imply pathology, though, underneath?
If there's a sexual problem, right? If a couple isn't having sex or there's some issue in their sexual relationship, not always, but most of the time, there's an underlying there's an underlying issue in the relationship. In most cases, what we find is that there's something that's going on in the relationship that is not allowing them to connect sexually. So often problems in the bedroom is just a symptom of something else going on, not feeling emotionally connected, having a lot of anger or resentment that has not been discussed, that's not been processed. You know, when you're pissed off at your partner, the last thing most people want to do is have sex with them, because that's a way in which you're really opening yourself up. If you, as a woman, do not feel emotionally safe with your partner, right, then you don't want to open up and be vulnerable with them. So there's often, you know, if you can't talk about sex, sometimes it means that you have a hard time communicating about other issues in the context of the relationship. So it's not at all uncommon that, you know, a couple will come to me for sex coaching, and we will spend, you know, a good portion before we get to the sex part. We're like talking about, so what's really going on in the relationship here? And are you able to communicate? And, you know, what do you guys have, you know, good boundaries with each other? So there's a lot of ways in which, you know, problems with the relationship shows up in the bedroom. And I always start by addressing the problems in the relationship, because once a couple is feeling good about each other, once they can really communicate, once they can have an emotional conversation, once they can express emotions, then it's much, much easier for them to start to feel like they want to be intimate with each other.
At what point, I'm trying to figure out how to put this question. Seems to me like we should get your book and give it to all the young women and young men out there. But at what point should we do that? Or should we wait till they're married?
Oh, no. I think that, you know, I think everybody, women and men of all ages will benefit from reading this book. But in terms of the educational component, no, I think that, you know, I think teenagers should be reading this book, right? Like, you know, we need to be, I've been talking to a lot of different sex educators, and one of the things that is becoming more apparent is that as the sex education dollars are being pulled from public school budgets, or, you know, they're substituting abstinence sex education instead of real sex education, it's really up to the parents to start educating our children around sex. In a way in which neither you or I had any type of education by our parents. At least I can't speak for yourself. I just can speak for me and what I know about people in my generation. So I think, you know, once kids are in their 14, 15, 16, a lot of kids are having sex at 12 and 13, right? They should be educated and they should be reading this book. So should the 40 and 50-year-olds, because a lot of it applies to them as well, and 60-year-olds.
And if you're going to do it right.
Exactly.
What's next for you? Another book?
Oh, I don't know. It was so exhausting writing that one. I am really focused on... I think what I'm really wanting to do is to, you know, I think writing the book was a way not to only tell my own story, because the book is very personal and vulnerable about my own issues around sexuality and shame and issues that I had growing up and in my marriage. But it was also a way to be able to get this information to more people rather than just having to work with me one-on-one. And so... what I'm really interested in doing is to, I have an online group coaching program for women, and I am really interested in expanding that so more women can participate and get this information and education at a lower cost, right? So I can provide this information, can be more accessible for women. And a lot of men have asked me, would you create something like this similar to, for men? And so I'm thinking about it. And I'm also considering starting a podcast. I already have you know, my website is Power of Pleasure, powerofpleasure.com. And I have a blog that comes out on a weekly basis, and I do YouTube videos and Instagram things. So, like, I'm out there doing stuff, but, you know, people are really urging me to do a podcast. So I'm considering, you know, kind of what you do, right? Like, just interviewing cool people and having conversations around sex. So I'm thinking about doing that for 2019. And, yeah, there's probably another book. There's probably another book inside of me somewhere, but yeah, I can't see it right now.
And I'd like to say thank you to this morning's guest, Jeanne Paillette. Her new book, Living an Orgasmic Life, Heal Yourself and Awaken Your Pleasure. Good advice for everybody. Thank you, Jeanne.
Thanks, Peter. Thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure. And it's been another edition of Conversation here on 94 WIPL Sports Radio. My name's Peter Solomon. It's raining out there, wet, nothing torrential yet, but Lord knows with this weather what it's going to turn out to be. It's going to get much colder this afternoon, so no matter where you go, take 94 WIP with you for a hot conversation. And speaking of hot conversation, stay tuned for WIP Sunday. If you can't, thank you to Phil Jackson, this morning's producer, and Ann Tideman Solomon, my wife and associate producer. Couldn't do these shows without either one of you. Nothing left to say, but see you soon. Good morning, and the conversation continues here on 94 WIPL Sports Radio as we ease on into a very wet WIP Sunday. Ease on into that good day as we have some good conversation. My guest this morning, Dr. Leo Transandi, and I hope I didn't murder his name. Dr. Transandi is an expert on chemicals, hormone-disrupting chemicals in our health and future. Good morning, Dr. Leo Transandi.
Good morning. Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. All right. Let me start with an obvious question. Our last hour, we talked about sex and women in particular, but men too. What's going on with men, women, sex, and hormones that disrupt our life?
Well, we do know that chemicals can scramble hormonal signaling of all types, and that includes sex hormones. The science has suggested most strongly effects of certain chemicals on the male sex hormone testosterone, which is important for libido, as well as a variety of other functions. It's even potentially a life or death matter, given that we know that low T is a risk factor or a marker for later heart disease and even death in men. So this is even a life and death matter in some cases.
How about for women? Any problems?
Well, studies have suggested effects of these chemicals on endometriosis and fibroids. While it takes time to do the studies carefully and completely, there are even studies suggesting increased risk of breast cancer.
Okay. How long have we known about this stuff?
Well, the first recognition that this might be a problem goes back to when pregnant women were receiving a pharmaceutical called diethylsilbestrol, which is a synthetic estrogen. The intentions were good at that point, and unfortunately, a few decades later, we realized that young girls exposed to that synthetic estrogen during their pregnancy developed certain cancers, and the evidence was astounding, but quite extremely strong. And that was the first alarm bell that messing with hormones, our natural signaling molecules, can produce disease and disability across the lifespan. Now, back then and after Silent Spring, we thought that these might be once-offs or effects that just occur in wildlife. But now we realize that the evidence suggests effects on human beings as well. Now we know of hundreds, if not thousands, of chemicals at this point that can scramble the signaling molecules in our bodies and contribute to a host of diseases. The evidence is especially strong for four categories of chemicals: flame retardant chemicals that are used in furniture, electronics, and carpeting, pesticides, which are used in agriculture, bisphenols, which are used in aluminum cans, as well as thermal paper receipts, and the phthalate chemicals, which are used in cosmetics, lotions, and even food packaging.
But yet we still use them all.
Well, that really results from a framework where we've introduced 1,000 to 3,000 new chemicals since the 1960s, if not earlier. We now have over 80, if not 100,000 chemicals in broad, widespread use. And what little we know suggests cause for concern, but the reality is that these chemicals were introduced in a framework that didn't require testing before they were used, especially for effects on developing children, not to mention the hormones in our bodies. So there's what we know, perhaps 1,000 chemicals at this point that are what we call endocrine-disrupting chemicals, but that is based on only a subset of all the chemicals because so few have been tested to begin with.
Amazing. Who does this testing, or who should be doing this testing?
Well, there are laboratories and academic institutions that have been doing a fair bit of the testing. The ideal scenario would be that an independent or regulatory agency would do these tests. Sometimes industry itself does these tests. There can be some concerns about the results of those tests, but insofar as someone does the testing, that's progress over the current situation where we have so many data gaps.
Is there a role for the government in all of this? I mean, should we be concerned with the shutdown? Testing's not happening?
Well, the testing is going on in a variety of ways, but not fast enough. The reality here is that we're dealing with chemicals that contribute substantially to disease and disability across the lifespan. We know now that endocrine-disrupting chemicals cost our society $340 billion, that's billion with a B, each year as a result of effects of these chemicals, ranging from young children not being as well able to perform in school, increases in obesity and diabetes, male and female reproductive conditions like we talked about at the top, and that's 2.3% of GDP. That's an annual cost, by the way, almost a tax insofar as these exposures continue. Now, you might throw up your hands because you might wonder if there's even a chance for changes in the regulatory structure in the current climate. But that's where there's a lot of opportunity for hope insofar as folks can take safe and simple steps to limit their own exposures. So avoiding canned food, for example, is a straightforward way to reduce your exposure to bisphenols, especially bisphenol A, which has gotten a lot of attention in the news. Watching the recycling number on the bottom of plastic bottles you're using is a great way to limit exposure. The numbers 3, 6, and 7 are the ones to avoid across the board. 3 is for phthalates, which we talked about already make plastic soft. They're the ones that in particular have strong evidence for messing with the male sex hormone, testosterone. 6 is styrene, a known carcinogen. And 7 is a catch-all category that includes some plant-based materials, but actually also includes bisphenols. And so it's difficult to really identify which ones in that group are safe. So avoiding 3, 6, and 7 are an important way to reduce exposure to chemicals of concern. In addition, I know a lot of folks on the program might be microwaving plastic under the pretext that it's microwave safe, but that's really meant for large-scale warping of the plastic material. What we know now is that there's microscopic changes in the material and the lining that can leach these chemicals and can get into food and ultimately into your body. In addition, it's important to avoid machine dishwashing with those harsh chemical soaps and high temperatures that can also break down the material. And obviously, if plastic is etched or scratched, it's a good time to throw that plastic material away. We also know that eating organic can reduce your levels of pesticide in your urine, such that you can reduce exposures, especially for pregnant women and children, that can impair a child's brain as it develops. And when it comes to flame retardants and furniture, the good news is that we have a new labeling system from 2013 onward that California put into place that requires companies say whether there are flame retardants in the upholstery that they've used in the furniture that you're purchasing. So looking on the label doesn't require a PhD in chemistry. It's a pretty easy step to watch out for any added flame retardants in those materials. And if you've got old furniture, I'm not suggesting anyone throw it away. If the furniture is worn down such that the upholstery is exposed, you can put a covering or other material over it so that the flame retardant doesn't leach out into the dust. Also, recirculating the air by opening the windows every day or two. Today might not be such a great day to do it with all the rain, but and cold, but recirculating the air gets rid of some of the persistent organic pollutants that can accumulate in the dust and can affect hormones, including thyroid hormone, as well as other functions.
I'm real curious about 3, 6, and 7 in recyclables. Should people in the recyclable industry be worried?
Well, there is an issue here in that we need to facilitate the kind of green chemistry and innovation that is so sorely needed. Now, there's a lot of hope here, too. There are we've seen a lot of social movements that have changed how manufacturing has occurred quickly. So, for example, that whole BPA-free movement a few years back was really not because of great science at the time. The science has even gotten stronger since that movement began, but it was consumer movement and concern about baby bottles and sippy cups that led to the changes that actually led manufacturers then to go to the Food and Drug Administration and insist on a ban of BPA in baby bottles and sippy cups. More recently, we've seen supermarket chains have to change their buffet-style food packaging because they've been identified to have what we call the forever chemicals, the perfluoroalkyl compounds, the Teflon-like chemicals that were found in the lining of these food packages and can disrupt thyroid function as well as impair growth of the baby in utero. And all of a sudden you saw pictures on social media of these two supermarket chains literally setting aside their old stock and supply. And then the manufacturers that provide these packages to the supermarkets had to change their whole production model. And that's the kind of change that we all can seek here as we try to deal with the more chemical reality that we face each day.
I'm old enough to have kids who are now grown, but in their day, we gave them plastic baby bottles. Should I be worried that we gave them something by accident?
There's a lot that we can do now to reduce our exposure, and you can get short, medium, and long-term results from changing the way you expose yourself in the environment. So you might see decreases in levels, for example, of bisphenols in a day, if not two, because the half-life or the time that it takes the body to excrete these chemicals is really short, a day or two before half of it's cleared from the body. Then you might see changes in hormones a week or two later. And then as months roll on, as you continue to do the right thing and avoid some of these chemical exposures of concerns, you can see the kinds of changes and reductions in disease risk that we're all hoping for. So there are short, medium, and long-term benefits to doing the right thing and changing one's lifestyle for the better.
Okay. And you're listening to WIP Sunday here on 94 WIP All Sports Radio. My name's Peter Solomon. We're talking about toxic chemicals in our life and a whole lot more with Dr. Leonard Trisande. Trisande. All right. Thank you, Dr. Trisande. His new book, Sicker, Fatter, Poorer, The Urgent Threat of Hormone Disrupting Chemicals in Our Health, to Our Health and the Future, and What We Can Do About It. More doctors, stay with me. Got to run a few commercials. We'll be back in just a bit. And we're back. We're talking toxic chemicals in our life and a whole lot more with Dr. Leo Trisande. His new book, Sicker, Fatter, Poorer, The Urgent Threat of Hormone Disrupting Chemicals to Our Health and Future and What We Can Do About It. Doctor, I want to talk about the poorer because it's worse in the poor ghetto, if you will, neighborhoods, isn't it?
Well, we like to say if a child comes home with one less IQ point, the mom might not notice, the teacher might not notice, but if 100,000 children come back with one less IQ point, the entire economy notices. And what we know now is that for each IQ point, a child loses 2% of his lifetime economic productivity. And if on average a kid makes $1 million over his lifetime, that's $20,000 lost. And if you multiply that out by 4 million people, the zeros start to add up on that right side of the number such that the costs get huge. And so we've found that endocrine-disrupting chemicals cost the United States $340 billion, that's billion with a B, dollars each year. That's a 2.3% decrease in our gross domestic product. So when companies come to me and say, well, these chemicals are so hard to change, they'll cost our economy, they'll slow our economic productivity, the reality is there are actually huge economic benefits to doing the right thing on the other side of the ledger. So the trade-offs aren't so simple as some would represent.
What chemicals are we talking about?
Well, the evidence is strongest for four categories of chemicals. The flame retardant chemicals that are used in electronics, furniture, even carpeting. Pesticides, which are used in agriculture. Bisphenols, which are used in the linings of aluminum cans and thermal paper receipts. And the phthalates, which are used in cosmetics, lotions, and even food packaging.
But how does that impact on the poor?
Well, it makes us all poorer as a society insofar as we all pay individually. $340 billion, are costs that we all bear. It's basically about a $1,000 tax that we all suffer as a result of these exposures. Now, we do know that certain racial ethnic subgroups and low-income populations can often suffer the greatest burden of these exposures because they have greater exposures to these chemicals based on where they live and where they play and where they go to school. And so they are, in some cases, literally poor as a result of these exposures.
All right. Poor, greater exposure, because if they're not shopping at a supermarket but rather at the corner store, they're more likely to pick up canned string beans than fresh string beans.
That's right. And also, we know that fast food in particular can actually increase your exposure to plasticizing chemicals or phthalates. So nothing that I'm saying in this book, by the way, suggests that unhealthy diet and poor physical activity aren't the biggest drivers, for example, of the obesity and diabetes epidemic that we're seeing today. But we increasingly know that these chemicals that I've described, especially the four categories that I focused on in the book, are potential contributors independent of diet and physical activity. So if you're eating fast food, obviously there are certain carbohydrates and fats that are not healthy, but there are also synthetic chemicals that can move the needle on the effects that that your diet can have on your body. So, for example, we know that bisphenol A, BPA, is the prototype obesogen. It makes fat cells bigger, disrupts the function of a protein that protects the heart called adiponectin. And because it's also a synthetic estrogen like diethylstilbestrol, which we talked about, it can have effects on body mass because we know that sex hormones influence how a child develops. So it can have a sex-specific effect on growth. In addition, we know that chemicals can also make it harder, literally, to lose weight. So a study recently looked at an intervention to reduce weight and then looked at levels of the perfluoroalkyl compounds, the Teflon-like compounds that we have in our bodies. And it found that the higher those levels were, the greater weight regain that folks had in the study. And what that means is that folks successfully lost weight, but if they were more exposed to begin with these chemicals, they simply regained the weight back and undermined their own ability to maintain a healthy weight. And what they found when they dug in deeper is that these chemicals were associated with slowing of the metabolic rate, like literally the burn rate of the human body was slowed, explaining the increase in weight that then nullified the decrease in weight that they tried to implement through healthier diet and physical activity.
And for many low-income neighborhoods, the housing stock is older, the schools are older, the plumbing is older, lead pipes, and lead paint on the walls.
Well, lead is a major contributor to disparities in youth. There's no doubt about it. But we've come so far with preventing lead exposure. We now know that getting lead out of paint and gasoline continues to contribute a $200 billion economic stimulus to our entire country because children are literally smarter as a result of getting lead out of paint and gasoline. I openly joke with the undergraduates I teach at NYU that they're literally 4 to 7 points smarter as a result of having lead levels that are 15 microgram per deciliter, that's how we measure lead levels, lower than what I did when I was a kid growing up in the 70s in downtown Manhattan. And so literally we've come so far in preventing exposures that literally drain our economy. That doesn't minimize what we see in Flint and other places across the country where lead in water can wreak so much havoc on a child's developing brain. But we have to keep in mind that we've come so far in reducing these exposures. We have to do a lot more work in focusing on water safety and making sure that water isn't treated in a way that erodes the old pipes that can leach, as you're hinting at, lead into water and ultimately into kids' bodies.
Well, what are your thoughts then on those water filtration systems you can buy?
Well, they're helpful in eliminating some of those metal exposures that are of concern. One of the things to keep an eye out is what your water authority describes about the chemical content in the water that they supply. So the good news is that we have a lot of regulation in place that requires cities and states to keep a careful eye on what they have in their water supply. The problem, as we've seen in certain circumstances, like in Flint, but also in other places, is that these legacy pipes can ultimately leach lead and other chemicals into the water just as it's getting to the tap. And that may be a reason why it's important to filter the water for those metals of concern. But again, the important thing to get out there is to ask your water authority for further information about what the water supply is like to begin with.
I've also been told that if you let the tap run a while before you use it, that helps.
Absolutely. Running it for 15, 30 seconds in the morning is really helpful. And the reason for that, and that can even make it less necessary to have the filter on in the first place, is that it gets the metals out that have settled into the water overnight. When you have a still tap overnight, it can literally erode at a smaller level the metals that then accumulate at a greater extent right at that first drain off the tap in the morning. So that's an important way to reduce your exposure.
All right. What about ADHD?
Well, we know that chemicals can disrupt thyroid function in the human body, and that thyroid function is crucial for a child's brain development. I used to be trained as a pediatrician to check a child's newborn blood spot, and we still do that to make sure that their thyroid levels don't require immediate treatment. But now we know that thyroid hormone during pregnancy can be terribly important for a child's brain development. We know that the baby doesn't make thyroid hormone till about the second trimester of pregnancy. And so if a mom's thyroid hormone function is disrupted, even to a subtle degree, beyond the ability to detect it on a clinical test by these chemicals, that you can produce outcomes like loss of IQ, even ADHD and autism, clinically significant outcomes. The science here is a little thinner simply because it's harder to study ADHD because it's not as common as, let's say, or it's not as easy, you don't find ADHD in the entire population, you find it in one of every 10 or so, and that can make it harder to study in a large population that you need to identify the kids who have ADHD and the kids that don't. But what little we know suggests, in particular, strong evidence for effects of pesticides and bromine flame retardants on the developing brain. And one of the ways that brain development can unravel is through attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. So in our work, we have also attributed a substantial amount of ADHD in the United States to these endocrine-disrupting chemicals.
Are the results that these chemicals cause reversible? Can we help?
Well, it's important, especially important, to prevent these exposures during pregnancy. But as I said earlier, there's a lot you can do now to reduce your exposure to these chemicals that can prevent disease in the long term. So no, not all is lost. The reality is that there are safe and simple steps we can do to limit these exposures that contribute to disease and have real benefits for people's lives in the here and the now.
Such as?
Well, avoiding canned food consumption is a straightforward way to reduce your bisphenol exposure. Saying no to that thermal paper receipt. So thermal paper receipts have a coating that's based in bisphenols these days, because that's what we've used to replace the old style typewriter kind of entry that would print in supermarkets and other places. But now we know that these thermal paper receipt coatings can get on your skin and ultimately absorb directly into the human body that way. In addition, I hate to make people self-conscious, we all have hand-to-mouth behaviors, kids especially. And so insofar as you touch that receipt and touch your face or touch your mouth, you ultimately pass the bisphenols into your body as a result. So there's a really neat website that describes these issues called bpa-free.me, and it's even gone viral these days. And the good news for that is that many supermarket chains are catching on and realizing that they actually need to offer people electronic receipts. So we're almost in a situation where the electronic receipts are pushing away and phasing out the old school thermal paper receipts that used to be so common. California just actually proposed some legislation to require that supermarkets offer these electronic receipts to everyone. And that is a really good step forward towards eliminating this concern to begin with.
What role should government be playing as opposed to what role is government playing in this whole issue?
Well, clearly there's a place for government to limit these exposures. And we've talked already about the benefits of getting lead out of gasoline and in paint, and that ultimately was through a federal regulatory action. We've also seen huge benefits from proactive intervention by the government on endocrine-disrupting chemicals. So back in 2000, the EPA negotiated a phase-out, actually banned, quite frankly, two pesticides in household use, chlorpyrifos and diazinon. And it so happened that a study at Columbia University in New York was looking at a population of pregnant women and children in neighborhoods where they were spraying these chemicals to prevent unwanted creatures and critters from causing trouble. And so they had a natural experiment in which they had higher exposed children followed by lower exposed children. And when they measured levels of the chlorpyrifos in babies' cord blood before and compared them to after the ban, they saw huge drop-offs in the levels of chlorpyrifos. And then before the ban, they showed effects of the chlorpyrifos on a child's head circumference as well as other birth outcomes, but they couldn't find those same relationships after the ban, suggesting that there was a real benefit of proactive policy action. So this is to say that there are benefits. Government can really do good things for people and protect them, even though we might not see it or feel it in the here and the now, might be concerned about the economic consequences. But there are huge economic benefits to be gained through this kind of proactive prevention. In the meantime, we all can take safe and simple steps to prevent these exposures in the first place. Now, most of what I've talked about so far are things you can do in your homes to reduce exposure. But there are many other places where we're exposed to these chemicals, in our workplaces, in our schools, in our subways, in our buses. And you might get sad and think that that's not an environment that we can change, but it's quite the opposite, actually. School systems have changed their cleaning product supplies because employees have gotten together and raised concerns. Even just asking what exposures are in a workplace can just start the conversation. And the reality is that if one major employer insists on products free of a particular chemical of concern, they have such huge market share that they can shift the behavior of a particular manufacturer such that it helps everyone. So the reality here is that we don't have to wait on government. Sure, government has a role, but there are benefits where we all band together and speak out on behalf of this issue. And it doesn't have to put people at risk for losing their jobs or affecting a company's bottom line.
And you're listening to WIP Sunday here on 94 WIP All Sports Radio. My name's Peter Solomon. More about toxic chemicals in our food and environment with Dr. Leo Transiti in just a bit. And we're back into the home stretch here on WIP Sunday with Dr. Leo Transiti, his new book about toxic chemicals in our environment. All right, doctor, do I need a PhD in medicine to read your book?
No, not at all. This is meant for all of us to hopefully read and enjoy. We've made it clear how to change the exposures that affect our lives, and there's a lot of hope in this book, and that's most important of all. We've talked a lot about effects on people's lives, but there are a lot of safe and simple steps folks can take now to produce real benefits and change their lives for the better. And the reality is that you don't need a PhD in chemistry. You don't need to know all the names of the chemicals or their structures to figure out what's going on. There also are some great videos that accompany the book on my website. That's Leo Trasande, LeoTrasande.com for more information. And even before reading the book, you can check it out for more detail.
Yes, Dr. Leo Trasande. Excellent book, doctor. Who'd you write the book for? Who should read it?
It's for everyone. I mean, the reality is that these are issues that don't just affect women and children. Sure, the evidence is greatest for effects of these chemicals on the developing brains of young babies and children. But these affect adults of all ages and stages of life. There is evidence, for example, for chemicals and their effect on prostate cancer, for example. In addition, as we talked about at the top, these are chemicals that can literally affect the male sex hormone, for example. So even if a guy is not thinking about having a child or isn't even planning it at all ever, these are things that can affect libido. I'm not saying the science here is definitive on which effects are produced by these chemicals on that function, but we've seen, for example, and this is striking, a nearly 50% drop-off in semen count and sperm count among adult men since the 1970s. And that's impossible to explain away on changes in the genome alone. It's clear that there's some, if not multiple, environmental factors that explain that phenomenon. And I'm not explaining away the entirety of that phenomenon on endocrine-disrupting chemicals. But, for example, studies have associated the plasticizing chemicals, phthalates, with decreases in sperm count among men who come, for example, to a fertility clinic. In addition, couples who've tried to conceive have been studied, and these couples who don't necessarily have fertility problems to begin with, had longer times to conceive based upon the exposure of the male partner to phthalates as measured in the urine. So these are things that affect guys literally, unfortunately, where it hurts, as much as it affects women and children and folks of all ages and stages. So this is something that all of us should listen up to.
I would think the health insurance industry would be going crazy over this stuff.
Well, these are costs that are also borne by health insurers. That's true. And so we all pay when we expose ourselves inadvertently or intentionally to these chemicals of concern. And that is cause for enough concern to begin with. So it's really through this book that I hope to get the broader message out there in a way that the general public can understand, and we can all get this out of what I think is a bit of a trap in the past. The perception has been, well, though this is for high-income folks who can do what might be the healthier, grungier granola kind of things to do, but the reality is we're seeing organic food going into big box stores, and the price margins have narrowed dramatically such that it's not really as costly anymore to do the right thing on behalf of one's health. Changing from canned food to frozen food for fruits and vegetables doesn't necessarily have to increase costs. Looking on the label for phthalates or fragrances doesn't necessarily change the price for these ingredients. And we're forgetting here that if you drive innovation on behalf of human health, there's a funny thing that happens, and that's that companies figure out how to make the product at the same price, and or even lower price without these chemicals of concern. We need the kind of transparency that would really move the needle on this issue, and it's by writing this book that I hope to get the word out in a more profound way so that we all can understand and do the right thing.
So it's really a book for consumers, for medical professionals, and for policymakers.
That's right. The medical community also needs to catch up. I mean, when I went to medical school, you had between 1 and 3 hours of environmental medicine or environmental health in the typical curriculum. That's less than one open-heart bypass surgery procedure, and trust me, I had my share of those where I had to hold retractors and things like that. So it just tells you how far the medical community also has to go. As doctors, we're a little afraid to say, I don't know, in response to a question about a concern like an environmental factor, and I get that. But the reality is, through this book that and other pathways, that even the medical community can catch up, and we're seeing the medical community step forward. So on endocrine-disrupting chemicals, the American Academy of Pediatrics has stepped up with concerns about additives in foods. The Endocrine Society, 17,000 endocrinologists and other scientists from across the world, 120 countries, have raised the alarm for this issue. The Federation of International Federation of Gynecologists and Obstetricians has also raised concern. So we're not talking about a lefty issue. We're talking about a mainstream public health issue that affects us all.
How about our own Food and Drug Administration?
Well, you might think the Environmental Protection Agency is the only agency for this issue, but the reality is that we have a more Swiss cheese framework for regulation in this space. And so in particular, when it comes to food, the Food and Drug Administration has a framework for these chemicals that are added into foods that is based on an older way of thinking about science. In particular, they've long taken the approach, the 500-year approach, that the dose makes the proverbial poison. But the reality is that we know of low-level exposures that can affect human health and contribute to disease. And that antiquated model isn't going to change overnight, but it speaks to some of the progress we have to make in science and understanding to really move the needle on this issue. And in particular, the American Academy of Pediatrics, in that statement I talked about, really insisted that the Food and Drug Administration modernize its approach to thinking about these chemicals of concern. Take, for example, BPA. So the Food and Drug Administration continues to assert the safety of BPA as used in aluminum cans for food, when its own data suggests effects at low levels of exposure in the range that we see humans in the United States each day. So the reality here is that we have to modernize our approach here, and it's not just the Environmental Protection Agency that has a role, but it's the Food and Drug Administration, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and other agencies that need to step up.
And I'd like to say thank you to Dr. Leo Trancidi. Doctor. I'm bad with names. His new book, Sicker, Fatter, Poorer, The Urgent Threat of Hormone-Disrupting Chemicals to Our Health and Future, and What We Can Do About It. Dr. Leo Trancidi. You have a website, Doctor?
Leo Trancidi, LeoTrancidi.com.
Thank you, Dr. Trancidi.
Thank you.
My pleasure. And it's been another edition of WIP Sunday here on 94 WIP All Sports Radio. My name's Peter Solomon. Stay tuned for Sports Talk with Sonny Hill. Always provocative discussion in the living room. Your opinions, Sonny's reactions. I know I'll be listening. Thank you to Phil Jackson, this morning's producer, and to my dear wife, Ann Tideman Solomon, my associate producer. Couldn't do the show without either one of you. And finally, there's nothing left to say, but see you soon.